Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Shattering, America in the 1960s, by Kevin Boyle. Narrated by Jonathan Yen. Preface. There were 180 million people living in the United States in 1961. The Shattering starts with a handful of them posing for a picture on the 4th of July. A number so small can't represent a nation so large, but they weren't a bad match. They were urban people in a nation dominated by cities and their surging suburbs, working people in an economy dominated by factories, native-born Americans in a country where immigrants' share of the population had tumbled to its lowest point in more than a century. They were husbands and wives in a country where 72% of adults were married, the younger couples raising their kids together at a time when 88% of parents with school-age children lived with their spouses. Every one of them was white, as were 85% of Americans, and they were to a striking degree safe and secure. Then the 60s cracked their nation open. What follows is a history of that crack-up. The idea is hardly new. For almost 50 years, historians have seen the 1960s and early 1970s, what they've come to call the Long 60s, as the pivotal point in the fracturing of modern American public life. Over time, their analyses have grown increasingly sophisticated, but the broad outlines have remained much the same. The United States emerged from World War II the most powerful nation on Earth, the argument runs, its diplomatic reach genuinely global, its economy three times the size of its closest competitor, and its military capabilities almost beyond imagining. For a few post-war years, politicians and policymakers struggled to make sense of the nation's new position. In the late 1940s, they began to reach an understanding of what needed to be done. Having failed to stand against Nazi Germany in the 1930s, they decided that the United States would now stand against its rogue state successor, the Soviet Union, as it tried to spread communism across the wounded world. The expansion of the nation's international commitments dovetailed with a drive toward domestic tranquility. The Cold War crushed American radicalism, while the nation's unparalleled prosperity convinced the Republican Party finally to support the liberal reforms of the 1930s and the Democrats to stop pushing for more. "The ideological age has ended," wrote the brilliant social critic Daniel Bell in 1959, "the old passions of the right and the left having been replaced by a relentlessly moderate consensus. A middle way," he said, "for the middle-aged, but not for the young." In the standard history, the shattering started with the idealism of a new generation unwilling to accept the compromises the consensus required. Bell had caught hints of it in 1959, though he thought it nothing more than young intellectuals yearning for a cause to believe in. By the time his essay appeared in April 1960, it was already coursing through the South in a wave of sit-ins, inspired by four college freshmen, the oldest of them barely 19. Over the next few years, it surged across the country, pulling young pacifists into the Freedom Rides, young organizers into Mississippi, young protesters into Birmingham's mean streets, young liberals into government service, young hipsters into the avant-garde, and young radicals into the open. In the rush of events that followed, they swept away the measured politics their elders had embraced. Precisely when the post-war accord collapsed remains an open question. Some versions date its fall to the latter half of 1963, when the civil rights movement broke the White South's grip on the Democratic Party. Others to the tensions that cut through the election of 1964. Yet others to the summer of 1965, when Lyndon Johnson escalated the war in Vietnam and a portion of South Central Los Angeles, a neighborhood called Watts, went up in flames. From there, the storylines shift. First, to the agonies of the left, then to the resurgence of the right, and ultimately to the intertwining of the two in the fiercely polarized politics of the Nixon years, a world removed from the 1950s. A nation that had believed itself to be at consensus, instead becoming one of two loosely defined congeries of Americans, each convinced that should the other triumph, everything decent and true and worth preserving would end, says Rick Perlstein in his marvelous history of Richard Nixon's rise. That was the 1960s. It's a powerful story, often beautifully told. But for a while now, the best scholarship on post-war America has been moving in ways that challenge its central premises. How does a story that begins with a consensus explain the rounds of repression and violence historians have uncovered in the 1950s, from the federal government's institutionalization of homophobia to whites' repeated assaults on African Americans who dared to move into their neighborhoods? How does a narrative that pivots on generational change incorporate historians' recent emphasis on the long histories of civil rights activism and modern conservatism? What happens to the polarization that closes the story, now that historians have developed a more subtle reading of the red-blue divide? How are we to understand the 60s, now that so much history has changed? The first step, the shattering argues, is to set aside the consensus politics and put in its place the particular interests of the post-war era's rapidly expanded middling classes, ordinary Americans with jobs to keep, kids to raise, pensions to build, mortgages to pay, and memories of harder times to put behind them. There, the dominant politicians of the 1950s made their stand, in defense of that swath of the nation Dwight Eisenhower called the common man. That commitment helped to give his foreign policy the mix of caution and aggression he believed the middling classes wanted to see, and it defined the intense focus on security at home, anchored by the warfare state Ike came to fear, the middling culture he loved, and the quiet extension of the nation's racial regime. Even at its mid-50s peak, that political order was a fragile arrangement, its boundaries repeatedly tested and occasionally broken. In the first half of the 1960s, they were fully breached. The young played a pivotal part in their wreckage, as the standard story says. So did older activists, steeped in traditions the previous decade's politics had marginalized. People like Ella Baker, the radical Democrat who gave the civil rights movement its vanguard organization. Estelle Griswold, the birth control advocate whose singular act of defiance won Americans a right they'd never had. Bayard Rustin, the radical pacifist who brought a 250,000 Americans to the Lincoln Memorial on a brilliant summer day in 1963 to demand jobs and freedom. And Lloyd and Dolores Herbstreit, the veteran McCarthyites who, on a snowy night in 1964, decided that Alabama's racist governor, George Wallace, ought to be president of the United States. As important as they were, though, activists alone didn't bring the order down. It also cracked from within, as some of its key constraints were stripped away by a transformative series of Supreme Court rulings, Lyndon Johnson's willingness to confront the nation's original sin, and his calculation that the country ought to fight a war he knew it couldn't win. As the barriers fell, the forces they were meant to contain surged forward, some of them moving precisely as the 1950s leading men had feared they would, others in directions they'd never imagined. It's true that the tumult plunged the left into crisis and reinvigorated the right, a process made plain in the chaotic summer of 1968, when millions of Americans responded to the violence engulfing the Democratic Party by taking up the Herbstreit's dream of a Wallace presidency. But that November, three times as many people voted for the candidate who'd painstakingly positioned himself as the champion of the embattled center, a politics he'd learned from the president he'd served. With that vote, the 1960s took their final turn, not to the polarization of left and right, though during the Nixon years there were moments so divisive reasonable people feared that the nation was coming undone, but to a bitter, often brutal struggle between an administration determined to reconstruct the order the decades' upheavals had shattered and those forces the shattering had released. A struggle for the nation's future shaped by the enormous weight of its past, as the rest of the 60s had been. That story can be told in any number of ways. I've given it a narrative form shaped from the intertwined histories of three of the 1960s' defining challenges. One, shaped by the African-American struggle to bring down the United States' long-standing racial system. Another, by the nation's foreign policy and the devastating war it produced. The third, by the government's right to regulate its citizens' sexuality. My focus on those challenges inevitably crowds out others. I barely touch on the Latino, Asian American, and Native American movements that developed during the decade. I give only passing attention to the campaign the resurgent women's movement waged to break gender discrimination in the workplace. And I spend no time at all on the United States' deepening role in the Middle East and environmentalism's remarkably broad-based challenge to corporate America, though the first Earth Day in April 1970 outdrew the era's largest anti-war protest by a margin of 10-1. Those were agonizing choices to make, but I'm convinced that the 60s are best revealed by diving deeply into those three defining struggles. Much of the narrative revolves around the massive political, economic, and social structures that, by the 1960s, had come to dominate American life. I'll argue, for instance, that it's impossible to understand the course of the Vietnam War without seeing how it became entangled with the financial order that connected the United States to the rest of the Western world. History isn't shaped by structures alone, though, no matter how powerful they may be. Individual actions matter too, as do the complex mix of experiences, beliefs, and emotions that lie behind them. That is why The Shattering burrows again and again into the lives of activists, politicians, and policymakers, and why it opens with a small group of people the post-war order was meant to serve, posing for a picture on Eddy Street. Chapter 1. Eddy Street. It started with an accidental shaming. Ed Cahill was chatting with his neighbor from across the street, Clarence Miller, as they'd done thousands of times since they were kids. In the course of the conversation, Ed happened to say something about how people didn't fly the flag as often as they used to. Clarence had to admit that he didn't have one to fly, but he promised to correct that by Independence Day. Then he did add one better, in the slightly competitive way of men who'd known each other forever. "Why not drape the entire block in flags?" he said. So they went door to door, offering to buy a flag for whoever didn't own one, and to hang it, too. When they had almost everyone signed up, Ed wrote a letter to the Chicago Tribune inviting all those who love Old Glory to come take a peek at the 6100 block of West Eddy Street on the northwest side of Chicago on the 4th of July. If the good Lord blesses us with a fine day, you'll find each and every home in the block proudly displaying the most beautiful flag in the world. As it happened, the 4th was cool and damp. But the flags went up anyway, 38 of them, though there were only 36 houses on the block. Having run Ed's letter, the Trib decided it might as well send a photographer out, too. He lined up as many people as he could on the lawn next door to the Cahill's bungalow and asked them to look up at the flags strung above them. The next day, July 5th, 1961, the folks on Eddy Street appeared on the Trib's back page. Ed and Clarence got the photo's center, kneeling alongside each other. On Ed's other side crouched his daughter Kathy, her arms wrapped across her chest and her hair pulled into pigtails. His son Terry was standing on the top porch step. And way in the back row, barely visible over his shoulder, stood his wife Stella, smiling for the camera. Stella. They'd moved to Eddy Street in 1948, 2 years after Ed had returned from the war. Stella knew how much that bungalow in the middle of the block meant to him. Yet when he'd brought up the possibility, she'd hesitated. She had her mother to think about, and his father, and all the other moves her family had made, some in hopes that they'd get themselves on solid ground, some in desolation. Stella's father had come to the States in 1908, the year he turned 18, from a town in what had once been southern Poland, but had long since fallen under Austrian rule. More than likely, he left because of the economic transformations that were then reaching into the Polish countryside. The age of machines, pounding down from Warsaw and Lodz, and ended up in Chicago because it seemed better to be in the center of the industrial world than on its ragged edges. It was a common calculation. 40 years earlier, there were 300,000 people living in Chicago. In 1909, there were 2.2 million, three-quarters of them foreign-born or the children of foreign-born parents, a solid portion of the rest migrants from America's own, increasingly marginalized countryside. They arrived in a city driven by the most modern forms of production. In its immense stockyards, meat packers processed 15 million head of cattle a year by moving their carcasses along a fully integrated assembly line. On its far south side, a labyrinth of blast furnaces and rolling mills made almost half of the nation's steel. Across its western border, in suburban Cicero, Western Electric's innovative new Hawthorne Works put 20,000 people to work assembling the telephones and switching systems that were transforming human communication. In between, along Chicago's tangle of rail lines, lay hundreds of smaller factories making whatever the market would bear, from chewing gum to women's wear. Around them circled the city's patchwork of neighborhoods. The fabulously wealthy held the Gold Coast north of downtown, the cultural avant-garde the less genteel area immediately to its west, where they celebrated anarchism, feminism, free love, and whatever else would shock the mainstream. The businessmen, the Loop, with its towering office blocks and Tiffany-encrusted department stores. The middle class claimed a ring of neighborhoods a respectable distance from the inner city, while the working class sliced Chicago's center into a series of ethnic and racial enclaves. Poles, northwest of downtown, Italians due west, Russian Jews to the south of them, Czechs to the southwest, Slovaks back of the stockyards, the Irish in nearby Bridgeport, and a growing number of African Americans, most of them refugees from the horrors of the white supremacist South, in a narrow band on the south side and two much smaller blocks on the west. Through those neighborhoods threaded the conflicts that gave Chicago's public life a furious feel. There was the city's long tradition of class conflict, stretching back to the earliest days of its breakneck industrialization. There was the intensifying violence along its racial borders as the black migration accelerated, and more there were clashes over its raucous sexuality. Since the mid-19th century, a nationwide core of solidly middle-class, overwhelmingly Protestant social reformers had been trying to prohibit practices that they saw as violations of the proper moral order. They'd had their successes. By 1890, the federal government had banned pornography from the mail. 24 states had outlawed the distribution of birth control, and abortion, once accepted as legitimate until the fetus started to move, had become illegal everywhere. But there was still plenty of work to do, the most pressing of it in cities like Chicago, where the reformers' order ran up against the breadth of American sexuality. Much of their energy went into shutting down the city's sprawling sex trade. Some 5,000 prostitutes serviced 5 million customers a year, many of them down in the levee, the thicket of brothels, dance halls, gambling parlors, and drug dens, squeezed between downtown and the African-American South Side. Others in flats, saloons, and cheap hotels scattered around the center city's neighborhoods. Alongside that crusade, the reformers built a campaign against Chicago's wide-ranging sites of sexual display. The strip shows, the drag balls, the dive bars, the bathhouses, and, on technology's cutting edge, a wave of titillating movies they tried to block by getting City Hall to set up the nation's first film censorship board. The reformers' high profile eclipsed the quieter struggles that ran through the working-class wards. At their center lay the network of institutions that tied Chicago's migrants to the worlds they'd left behind, from the South Side's Masonic lodges and storefront churches, through the West Side's transplanted synagogues and ethnic halls, to the enormous national parishes the Catholic Archdiocese built across the inner city. Occasionally, one or another would add its name to a reformer's campaign. For the most part, though, they traded politics for the intimate work of preserving their community's traditional, often intensely conservative, sense of propriety, order, and obligation against the corrosive power of distance, displacement, temptation, and the poverty that clung to the working classes even in the center of the industrial world. It clung to Stella's father, too. He'd probably left home with at least some training as a tailor, maybe even with a formal apprenticeship behind him. But he had to settle for running a sewing machine in a downtown sweatshop, a job that paid for repetition rather than skill. 2 cents a jacket lining, properly sewed. 4 cents a pant seam. The weekly total reduced by the cost of whatever cloth he spoiled with an errant stitch. At some point, the orders would stop coming in, and his boss would shut the sweatshop down to let his inventory clear. His first full year in Chicago, her father went 10 weeks without any work whatsoever. The only way to manage was to cut costs to the bone, which was undoubtedly why he took the cheapest housing he could find, renting out a bed from a presser and his wife in one of the 5 apartments someone had squeezed into a narrow old 2-story deep in the Polish ghetto. He was still there 5 years later, when he met Stella's mother. She was a country girl, raised in a backwater village 80 miles south of Krakow, in a family that seemed to hemorrhage its sons and daughters. Her brother had left in 1908, her sister in 1909, she and another brother in October 1912, following the trail the other two had set from their slowly shrinking home through Hamburg and Ellis Island to the same corner of Chicago Stella's father had settled into. Their courtship should have been policed by her siblings and the Polish priests who ran the three mammoth Catholic churches that dominated the streets around the flat she shared with her sister. But in the ghetto, traditional authority didn't always hold. Stella's mother and father were married in the Baroque splendor of the Church of the Holy Innocents on June 24, 1914, a 24-year-old tailor clinging to his tattered trade, and his 18-year-old bride, who, on her wedding day, was at least 6 weeks pregnant. The following February, their son Chester was born. The next year, 2 days after Christmas, 1916, they had Stella. A few months later, the United States went to war. The mobilization stretched across the country through draft calls, bond drives, and feverish demonstrations of Americanism. But it only reached her family in the cataclysmic autumn of 1918 when the Spanish flu came roaring down from the army camps north of the city. They buried Stella's father in a spitting October rain. Afterward, her uncle took them in, because somebody had to save them from tumbling into destitution. But he couldn't keep them forever, not with 4 children of his own to raise. So, in January 1920, Stella's mother married again. Her new husband was also a Polish immigrant, who'd come to the States 10 years before without a trace of skill to sell. Sometimes a man in his position pulled himself up into factory work. He had stayed mired in the vast pool of common laborers who filled the lowest level of the working class, where a man took the sort of job that required nothing more than a strong back, hauling bricks, shoveling snow, laying streetcar lines, and hoped to hold it until the weather turned or someone stronger came along to replace him. The burden of his working day he softened with nights of drinking he couldn't control, which must have cost him a share of jobs he couldn't afford to lose. Maybe Stella's mother married him out of love, though it looked like desperation. If the strains that ran through Stella's new family had an obvious marker, it was their shuffling from place to place. The year she turned 7, they spent in a 4-flat, 5 blocks back of the stockyards, close enough that she must have gone to school each morning reeking of the pens. The next year they were in a carved-up workman's cottage in the Polish ghetto, close to where her father had died. The year after that, down near the yards again, and the following year in another carved-up cottage in the West Side Jewish enclave. The other strains she was too young to understand. But there was some reason why her mother never had another baby, though she was only 25 when she remarried, and why she never gave Stella and her brother her stepfather's name. Then the economy collapsed. When the slide started in the summer of 1929, they were living in an overflowing 3-flat in the Czech neighborhood, her stepfather hauling furniture and her mother packing boxes in a candy factory to cover the rent. By the spring of 1930, he'd been let go, and the family was getting by on her paycheck alone. It wasn't enough. Stella's brother left school first for a job out in a Cicero metal plant. He probably landed because of the half-finished shop course he was leaving behind. Stella stayed long enough to complete the school's 2-year commercial course. As soon as she was finished, in June 1932, she went to work, too, in one of the city's secretarial pools. She was 15. They were lucky to find anything at all. In April 1930, Chicago's unemployment rate reached 10.8%. 18 months later, it was at 8%. Other cities were hit just as hard. Gary, Indiana, lost 90,000 jobs in 1930 and 1931 as the demand for steel crumbled. Detroit, 250,000 as the auto industry slacked.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?